You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. The Wisconsin High School football playoffs will hold their Level 3 round tomorrow night with eight teams left at each division level of play across the state. But not every team in Wisconsin was able to finish even their regular season this year because of a shortage of players. For example, Bigfoot High School in Walworth and Waukesha South High School were among those that had to cancel games because of injuries. East Troy High School forfeited their entire varsity season because they didn't have enough players to field a team. That continues a trend of decreasing high school football participation in our state. Data from the National Federation of State High School Associations found that from 2009 to 2019, Wisconsin had the biggest decline of any state in the country. We're exploring what might be contributing to this trend, what impacts it could have on kids and sports, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen this in your district, on your team, or your kids' team? Why do you think fewer kids are playing high school football here in Wisconsin? Would you like to see more participation in the sport, or do you think the decline in football isn't maybe such a bad thing? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Travis Wilson is the general manager of the Wisconsin Sports Network and the football editor of wissports.net, covering high school sports around Wisconsin. Travis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Happy to be on to talk high school sports, and always good to talk about high school football.
Now, we've mentioned a few different schools canceling games, maybe even their whole season. Are you seeing a fair amount of teams around the state either hitting that point or maybe right on the edge of having enough players to compete?
It has been something that has continued for a number of years, actually. There's unfortunately always a couple schools that usually know they're going to have challenges at the start of the year with participation numbers. And at some point during the season, because of injuries, because of ineligibility, whatever it might be, have to hit pause and cancel a game. Sometimes they have to cancel the end of their season. Not something that you like to see, obviously, but it is relatively rare, maybe one or two schools per year. There are some schools that cancel before the season starts, or maybe we'll move from 11-player football to 8-player football. But teams are trying the best they can, and sometimes it gets to the point where you can't field a competitive team. And depending on the school, they might have enough players out for football. For instance, in the instance of Waukesha South, a large school, a good-sized school with over 1,000 enrollment, they had enough players to have a team, but a lot of them were underclassmen. They did not have a lot of seniors out for football this year, and they play in the best conference in the state, in the Classic 8 conference, and throwing a bunch of freshmen and sophomores out there against high-level juniors and seniors was not going to be a good situation for them. So they did cancel a game earlier this year. But, again, not something you like to see, but it is relatively uncommon.
Now, you mentioned not wanting to put those underclassmen in the game. If you've got a track and field team, okay, you don't have enough seniors. Well, those freshman runners might lose by a lot, but that's okay. A contact sport, especially one like football, are you hearing from athletic directors, yeah, we don't want to put those kids in if they're not physically ready because they might be more at risk of injury in those cases?
That's absolutely the case. Football is a contact sport, like hockey, like wrestling, where it really is tough to have younger kids go out there as 14, 15-year-olds competing against 17 and 18-year-olds sometimes. So, you don't want to have that situation. Sometimes you have to. Sometimes there's players that are ready for that. But it is, not the norm that you have a bunch of freshmen out there. And again, based on the size of the school, especially challenging. At smaller schools where it might be a Division VII school, it is fairly common to have freshmen and sophomores play. It just depends on if they're ready.
Now, with the trend like this, I might wonder, is this COVID? Except those numbers I referenced went through 2019, showing that 10-year decline. That was before COVID. I might think, it must be a nationwide trend, but the same numbers show at least some states like Texas are having more participation in football. I assume a question a lot of people in the sport in the state are asking, Travis, is why? What's going on? Why are we seeing a steady decline in football participation in Wisconsin high schools?
Well, I think a few important points to note. First of all, the numbers that were referenced in the article that you referred to are 11-player football numbers specifically. And Wisconsin is one of 27 states that offers a reduced football player option. In Wisconsin, that is an 8-player option that really didn't become popular or really didn't become a resurgence until about 2013, when a group of about 16 schools started playing reduced player football, 8-player. And now we're up to about 60 schools playing 8-player football. In this year, for the most recent year, which would have been the 2022-23 season, there were over 1,100 students participating in 8-player football that are not included in the 11-player numbers that you reference. We've also seen declines in overall enrollment throughout the state of Wisconsin. That's something that, you know, I've seen a number of articles and a number of concerns over declining birth rates, lower enrollment numbers in schools in general. So when there's lower numbers in school, it is going to lower the number of participants. And if you look at total high school participation in Wisconsin, not just football, that number has decreased since 2009 as well. So there have been some decreases in football. I think if you look at overall participation rate in football between 11-player and 8-player, it's not quite as bad as maybe the article makes it out to be. And again, Wisconsin is losing young people, you know, having smaller enrollments in schools, whereas other states may be growing. So that does lend itself as well. But in terms of why there may be lower participation numbers in football, there certainly was, you know, a sharp decline in the mid 2010s. And that kind of coincided with, you know, a large amount of press, a large amount of discussions around concussions at that time in the NFL, in college, and of course in high school and youth football. And that scared away, you know, some participants, some parents that decided it wasn't the best opportunity for them. There have been some great rules, accommodations and rules changes that have been made over the last decade or several decades to address and improve safety at the high school football level. You know, many of the people in the high school football realm, you know, say this is the safest the sport has ever been, with all the rules, with all the equipment, with all the limitations on contact. But, you know, we are seeing some resurgence in participation numbers as well, despite declining enrollments in recent seasons. We did see big drops during COVID. That had a huge impact on all sports, but especially football. But we're starting to see some nice improvements and nice increases in high school football and youth football over the last couple of years.
Talking to Travis Wilson with Wisconsin Sports Network and wissports.net, looking at the present and future of high school football in Wisconsin. Some teams having trouble fielding full teams, others switching, as he mentioned, and we'll get into this more, to 8-person teams. You could join in with your experiences, your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Denny is with us in Ogdensburg. Denny, hi.
All right, thanks for taking my call. My grandson played high school football in Wisconsin, left tackle, played 4 years on a full college ride, was very good. He could have gone a fifth year, paid for it, to get a master's degree, and he said, I've had enough. It's a little bit of a concussion issue for us as parents. He's a 4-point student, but he chose his path. But there are a lot of other injuries when you start playing at that level. You're injured almost all the time. It worked out well for him, but that was his decision to make. And we were concerned about concussions in the mid-teens also.
Denny, thanks a lot for the call. Denny's sharing an experience. Well, congratulations on getting that full ride to college. Not every player is going to get that. But Travis, it sounds like a family weighing that decision of concussion, going with yes, play football and all the way through college.
Yeah, and obviously that's a decision for parents to make, not only in high school, not only at college, but also in youth football or youth sports in general. You know, there's risks involved in participating in sports. I'm a youth football coach myself, have coached youth football for 9 years. And, you know, it happens. There's injuries that happen just like there are in any sport. You know, we have great trainers that we work with in our community that help. We have practice guidelines in place. We have rules within the leagues that we play to try to minimize and limit possible injuries. But ultimately, it is a contact sport that it is up to each family and each parent to decide if that's something that they would like to pursue.
Thanks for sharing that story, Denny. We're talking to Travis Wilson from wissports.net about a decline in high school football participation in Wisconsin, but maybe some signs of a resurgence. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What does high school football mean to you and your community? Is it still the marquee sport at the local high school? Did you play or watch in high school? Are you on a team right now? Maybe getting ready for a playoff game, or is your kid? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Travis Wilson, general manager of the Wisconsin Sports Network, football editor of wissports.net, which covers high school sports around Wisconsin. We are talking about high school football, some declines in participation over the years, some bounce back maybe post-COVID, some schools struggling to field teams or switching to eight-player teams. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's focus in on eight-player football. Now, we're ahead of the curve a little bit. About 5 years ago, I talked to Paul Micklig, head coach and co-athletic director at Newman Catholic High School in Wausau, still there, I believe, about why his school made the change. Here's a listen.
When it comes down to it, there's two factors, and the first one was player safety. With the numbers in our school going down to we're at an enrollment of 119, and we have a couple sports in the fall that we offer. We were the last year, 2 years ago, when we were an 11-man, we had 19 kids that we had playing in our last game that didn't have a JV, so you couldn't develop the younger kids, and it just wasn't. We were taking some hits and hards, and guys were getting hurt all over the place. So we were trying to make sure that safety was our number one priority, and how can we get these guys safe.
We got a caller, I think, with experience with the eight players on a side football. Andy is with us in Central Wisconsin. Andy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a son that's played eight-man football now for a couple years in a smaller school, and you talked about how it's enrollment versus participation. You got some schools here that are coming into eight-man that have the same enrollment possibly, but you're talking higher participation. You got schools showing up with 12, 13 kids for the whole team playing both sides of the ball, and you want to talk about safety. And then you go to these schools that have way higher participation. These kids are getting killed. I mean, you got 45 kids standing on the sideline that are 6'2" and 300 pounds, and by halftime it's 40-0, and the smaller school with the lower participation has got more kids, I believe, coming off with concussions and stuff like that. I just don't know if eight-man, for them schools, if you want to go by enrollment, I get that. But, when you could play three more kids easily, it just makes it, if it's a safety thing, I don't think it really is, because I think some of these kids or schools that are having lower participation are getting hurt. And gotcha. I think them schools that have higher participation should be playing 11-man football and not just dominating in the 8-man, where you have schools that are coming in that they just want to play football.
I gotcha. Andy, thanks a lot for the call. Travis, a couple of perspectives you heard on 8-man football. What are you seeing out there?
Well, we've certainly seen an increase in the number of schools that are offering 8-player football, that are seeing that as an opportunity to continue to have a football program that may be a better option for them, as opposed to co-opting with another school and continuing to play 11-player football. It really is and was designed for the smallest schools. In fact, the WIAA has a cap, and the WIAA is the governing body for high school sports in Wisconsin. They have an enrollment cap of 200 students in the high school for a team to be eligible for the eight-player playoffs. Again, trying to keep it for the smallest of the small schools under that 200 enrollment level. There are some schools that participate in eight-player football with enrollments above 200, generally not very far above, but they are not eligible for the playoffs. And it has been a real great opportunity for schools to continue to offer high school football at the eight-player level. And a little history on that: back in the 40s, 50s, and even into the 60s, there was a high number of eight-player teams around the state. And then when school consolidation happened during that time, schools got larger, and they kind of phased out the reduced player option until it was brought back in about 2013. So it really has been a great way for schools to continue to offer football. Again, it is designed for the smallest schools, and we are seeing generally those smaller schools that are gravitating towards eight player to be able to continue to offer football.
Thanks for the call, Andy, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to John now in Darlington. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Question for your expert there. What role is soccer having on football numbers? Is the emergence of the popularity of soccer maybe drawing numbers away from some smaller and medium-sized football programs?
Interesting question, John. Is the other football drawing away from American football, Travis, do you think?
I think it certainly is in some communities. You know, when you have a small school, a rural school with maybe 300 or 400 students, you don't have a lot of boys that will play sports or can play sports. And so if you have multiple sport opportunities, it does become a challenge. And, you know, some of the schools that we mentioned that had to drop their football programs this year, Bigfoot being one of them, East Troy, you know, those are kind of smaller mid-sized type schools that do offer soccer as an option. And I think that has cut into some of the numbers that they have in football. If you're a school that offers soccer under, you know, 300 or so, you're really starting to spread those athletes thin, and it can be a challenge to field competitive teams where you're talking about too high, number of participants that you need for those sports. You have 11 on the field at a time in both football and soccer, and it's just a challenge to have that many. I think of a school like Wisconsin Heights, located in just outside of Madison, a school that is traditionally about 250 or under 250 enrollment that offers football and does offer soccer. And that's one of the schools that has dropped to 8-player football with a little bit larger enrollment because they were having a challenge in 11-player football, I think in part because it's just hard to have that many programs going at the same time.
Thanks for the call, John. We're talking to Travis Wilson with the Wisconsin Sports Network and wissports.net, looking at the future of high school football. Some schools switching to 8-player teams, some occasionally having to cancel games or even seasons because of a shortage of players. Back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Sheboygan. Mike, hi.
Hi. I've noticed that the seasons seem to be longer. Our football season started sometime in mid-August, and now they're starting in early August. And I think there's a little bit of burnout when you start a football season so early, and maybe part of it is burnout.
Mike, thanks for the call. Have high school football seasons gotten longer over the years, Travis?
The number of games has not changed. The season has stretched a little bit. Going back about 10 years or so, prior to that point, the Wisconsin football playoffs and the end of the regular season were condensed to a point where the last game of the regular season and the first two games of the playoffs took place in a span of about 10 or 11 days. And teams were playing three games in 10 days. And that was determined to not be a safe situation for those student athletes to have that much contact in such a short amount of time. So to alleviate that, they did push back up the start of the of practices in the fall. So now they start in the first week in August, as opposed to it used to be, you know, sometime around August 10th, 11th, something like that. So it was done for safety, but it did kind of move up that start date a little bit. And that has been a continued point of discussion, maybe a little bit of a challenge for some people. But again, I think with safety in mind, it was certainly the right decision at that time.
Thanks for that call. Time for one more caller. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Hi. I just wonder, as far as there being a shortage because of injuries, how many of those injuries are because of contact injuries, or maybe it's because the players just aren't all that familiar with the move, so maybe they end up with aches or pains or strains that maybe a physical therapist or a chiropractor could deal with, so it wouldn't aggravate things. And if there aren't enough people for the offensive line, then the defensive players can say one Mississippi, two Mississippi.
Dennis, thanks for the call. First of all, those non-contact injuries, a factor in pretty much any sport. Travis, what goes into trying to prevent those?
Well, one of the great things that has happened over the last few years is more and more schools are employing athletic trainers either at a full-time rate, maybe by contracting with a local hospital or a healthcare provider, or at least having them available more frequently. When I was in high school back in the mid and late 90s, we didn't really know what an athletic trainer was, to be honest with you. It was the doctor that you went to if you had a problem the next day. And now at many high schools, there is at least one, if not two, athletic trainers at every game, certainly, and at most or all practices as well. And they've been able to work with student athletes and keep them healthy, provide them with rehabilitation opportunities, identify injuries, identify, you know, the difference between being hurt and being injured. If it's just a bump or a bruise that you can continue to play through, or if it's something that does require, you know, additional treatment, either with the trainer or with your healthcare provider, that's been a big, big plus over the number of years as more and more schools embrace the athletic trainers and what they're able to do working with not only football programs, but all athletic programs at schools.
Dennis, thanks for that call. And just our last less than a minute, Travis, are you hopeful that we can get more kids involved in school sports, football, and all the rest?
Well, I am a huge advocate for education-based athletics, and I love high school sports. Obviously, it's my job and I do and what I love. Yes, and we are seeing positive trends. Nationwide, 11-player football participation increased last year for the first time. It was the first year-over-year increase since 2013. Again, that's nationwide. Overall football participation, boys and girls, 11-player and reduced, was up 6% last year from the previous year. So we're seeing good trends. We're seeing good things happen. High school football is a great experience, and I certainly encourage everyone to consider it and make it a worthwhile opportunity.
Travis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Appreciate you having me.
That's Travis Wilson, general manager of the Wisconsin Sports Network and football editor of wissports.net. He was with us today to look at why Wisconsin high school football participation decreased over a 10-year period and signs, at least at the national level, of a bounce back. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Governor Tony Evers is suing Republicans in the state legislature over their decision to block pay raises for UW system employees until diversity initiatives on campuses are stopped, and the decision to block some conservation projects proposed under the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program. Here's Governor Evers.
When the Republicans decided that 35,000 people that work for the UW system shouldn't get a raise without having any legislation that gives them that authority. That's just bullshit.
Evers argues that because these decisions were made in committees rather than through a full legislative vote, lawmakers are violating the state constitution's rules on separation of powers. The governor's office is requesting that the suit go directly to the state Supreme Court, according to a statement that's due, quote, to its significant statewide importance, as well as the exigent harms caused by Republicans' unconstitutional obstruction. We're talking about Governor Evers' lawsuit against Republican lawmakers, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think state lawmakers, Republicans in particular in the legislature, are overreaching their powers? What are your thoughts on pay raises being blocked for UW system employees until diversity initiatives on campuses are stopped? Do these actions rise to obstruction of government function since they were decided in committees? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee and a former member of the Wisconsin State Legislature. Mordecai, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Glad to be here.
Good to have you back. Now, how common is it for the governor of Wisconsin to sue the legislature of Wisconsin?
You know, this is pretty unusual and pretty odd. And what I'm fearing is that we in Wisconsin have gotten so partisan and deeply rooted in our partisan identity that, you know, some people who are Republican will immediately say, oh, this is dumb. And some people who are Democrats will say, oh, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. I'm hoping that over the next half hour, we can talk about this in a nonpartisan way based on the principles at hand of what would generically be called a legislative veto.
Let's talk about that. Before we get into the particulars, it seems like this is a core issue, this idea, and correct me if I'm summing this up wrong, Mordecai, but legislation passed that grants the legislature, through some of its committees, power to do some of the job that's usually done by the executive branch. It seems like that's the core of this separation of powers dispute. Now, before we get into the dispute itself, it's been a couple sessions since you were actually in the legislature yourself, Mordecai. But back in the day, was this a common practice that a law would be created and then a committee in the legislature would be part of overseeing the execution of that law?
Well, back in the day, it was very limited. There was the committee, it's called by its abbreviation, JOKER. And a JOKER was a joint committee that had final approval for pay raises. And so that's no different from what we're talking about today in terms of UW employees. There was the JCRAR, Joint Committee for Review of Administrative Rules. That committee could suspend an administrative rule that was already in effect without going to the full legislature. But that was about it in those days. It's become much more common since we've had a situation of a legislature dominated by one party and a governor's office dominated by the other party.
Given that there's that precedent, though, could a court look at this and say, well, you've been doing this in one way or another for a lot of years. We've got a longstanding precedent, so that's okay. That's how Wisconsin works.
You know, I think the precedents are relatively limited. In other words, a court could say, okay, you've done pay raises this way, since time immemorial. Although you've never done it in a way that only gave it to some state employees and not to other state employees. So that's a line of argumentation. JCRAR, in terms of suspending an existing administrative rule, was relatively unusual in those days. And it certainly didn't have to do with preventing a rule from going into effect. So it's possible that you could have a judicial decision that says, what is remains is, but all this other new stuff we're going to look much more closely at.
So let's look at that phrase you brought up earlier, legislative veto. Could you talk about what you mean by that and what it means for us?
Yeah, I think it all goes back to what was that ABC TV show? I think it was Schoolhouse Rock.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the episodes was called I'm Just a Bill. And frankly, that was a much better explanation of how a bill becomes a law than any 50-minute lecture by a professor. I'm guessing that a lot of your listeners might remember it, or even some people might remember the basics of how a bill becomes a law back from high school civics. But the essential principle that all of us really take for granted and don't think about much is that in our constitutional system, the legislature passes bills, and then a governor can either decide to sign it or veto it. In other words, the enacting something belongs to the legislature, and vetoing it belongs to the chief executive. What a legislative veto does is it turns the process upside down, where a governor or a president proposes something, and then the legislature vetoes it. It might veto it through a one committee. It might veto it through a one house vote or even a two house vote, but it turns the situation backwards. And so I think that the state Supreme Court is going to be interested in looking at this in principle, and in part because the U.S. Supreme Court made a relatively similar decision back in 1983, and that might end up being a pretty prevailing precedent.
Talking to Mordecai Lee, Emeritus Professor at UW-Milwaukee, looking at Governor Evers' lawsuit against the Republican-led state legislature over using committees to block certain laws from coming into full effect. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your thoughts, your questions, 800-642-1234. Okay, let's dig into the particular issues being brought up in this lawsuit now. They've got some of the general stuff in there, Mordecai. First of all, Evers suing over, you mentioned the Joint Committee on Employee Relations, JOKER. They approved this pay raise that had been passed in the state budget, 6% pay raise for all state employees, except for those in the UW system. disclaimer, everybody at WPR is under the UW system. Anyhow, can you talk a little bit about that dispute?
Here's a situation where the ideological politics of the legislature versus a Democratic governor are really clashing. If you peel back just a layer or two, the logic of the linkage becomes clear. But I think, like you, Rob, I should put in the disclaimer that as Professor Emeritus, I'm no longer an employee of the university, and therefore I don't have any skin in the game. I'm not affected by this. But here you've got Speaker Voss, a very powerful speaker, a Republican speaker, who says that he's against the university having diversity activities, equity activities, and he wants the legislature to, he wants the university to abolish those offices. And he's using this as a kind of leverage. He's saying, I won't permit Joker to give all university employees the pay raise we have approved for other state employees until UW abolishes its what they're called DEI, its diversity and inclusiveness offices. And the president of the university has been very clear that this does not seem fair, and that there seems he also is willing to defend DEI at UW as being reasonable. And so now we're at loggerheads. So you've got the speaker looking for leverage, and this is one of them.
Then the other issue, not quite as high profile, it's something we've talked about on the show over the last year or so, the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Program. This is the Joint Finance Committee gets to review some of these projects, has blocked some, according to the petition from the Attorney General here, without providing explanation for why they were blocked. Pelican River Forest Conservation, Cedar Gorge Clay Bluffs were a couple of those. I don't know if this is the headline part of this story, Mordecai, but what do you think about that part of the suit?
Well, there are probably two factors here. One of them is the principle of a committee making a decision, a committee exercising a veto. It's a little bit parallel to when we talked about Joker. The other one is the committee exercising the veto based on an anonymous objection. I think those are sort of two different animals, and I hope they won't sort of be confused and intertwined. I don't recall from my years in the legislature a similar situation like this, but certainly one can describe this as a legislative veto that DNR has approved a grant of money to acquire land for conservation purposes, and that a committee of the legislature is vetoing it, as opposed to, similar to Joker, as opposed to the legislature opposing it. So it's the principle of can a subunit of the legislature exercise a veto, and even can the legislature as a whole exercise it as a veto as opposed to as a law? And that gets back to where we started the conversation, how a bill becomes a law. The legislature can pass any bill it wants. It can pass a bill that says, we don't want to fund, you know, X conservation project, and then a governor can either sign it or veto it. That, I think, is what the governor is trying to get at.
Mordecai Lee is with us, Professor Emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, former member of the Wisconsin State Legislature, talking with him about Governor Evers' lawsuit against Republican lawmakers for what he alleges is a violation of the state constitution's rules on separation of powers. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a reaction to this lawsuit? Are you following it closely? Do you think the state legislature is exceeding its constitutional authority? Join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Mordecai Lee, Professor Emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, former member of the Wisconsin State Legislature, looking at Governor Evers' lawsuit against Republican members of the legislature for what he says is a violation of separation of powers, pointing in this, at least in this particular lawsuit, to refusal by lawmakers to extend pay raises to UW system employees that have been approved previously in the budget. Also, some stewardship programs being blocked by anonymous lawmakers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on those two particular issues? The wider question of constitutional authority, is the balance being tipped too far in favor of the legislature? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Mordecai, we have, as we've talked about, two specific examples here. Is it possible that a decision by the court, and we don't know what that would be, is it possible that a decision by the court would affect a lot more cases like this where legislative committees have more comparable authority to these cases?
I think the best way to answer it is to look at the precedent from when the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision about legislative vetoes in 1983. It was a decision about the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and it's known as the Chadha decision because Mr. Chadha was the one who was suing INS about his citizenship. But what the U.S. Supreme Court decided then was that the method by which the U.S. Congress cast a legislative veto against INS was unconstitutional because it only required one house of the U.S. Congress to exercise the veto, as opposed to what we're used to from high school civics, two houses of Congress making a joint decision. And so as a result of that decision, Congress gradually stopped inserting the option of legislative vetoes in bills that it was passing, in laws that it was passing. And it gradually fell out of disuse. I researched this when it came to a president having a power to reorganize the federal government, where the president had to submit a plan to Congress based on a law that Congress had passed. And then Congress had the power to veto the proposal, the plan, but only both houses of Congress would have to agree to the legislative veto. But I think, based on the historical record, ever since the 1983 Chadha decision, the Congress never renewed a president's power to submit reorganization plans, because I think they realized that the Chadha decision also made their legislative veto power, even though it was both houses, probably suspect under the Constitution. And I think that's how the state Supreme Court is going to proceed.
Now, I'm looking back at the end of 2018, after Governor Evers won an election before he came to power. There's a lot of attention to some so-called lame duck laws passed by the Republican legislature and then outgoing Republican Governor Scott Walker. One of those gave the legislature the power to permanently block regulations written by the state's administrative agencies. Those are part of the executive branch. Are some of those decisions made in that brief window between the election day and inauguration day for Governor Evers, are those part of the story here, where you had a governor willing to at least cede at least some authority to the legislature?
I think this is one of those cases where, unfortunately, we have to look at it through a partisan prism. And note the hypocrisy and double standards that we're seeing from politicians on from both parties. So in the incident that you instance that you described, it was Republicans wanting to proactively prevent a Democratic governor from having certain powers. And so Democrats complained that this was just so unfair because they didn't do it to a Republican governor, and now they're doing it to a Democratic governor. So now the shoe is on the other foot, and Democrats, through this lawsuit, are hoping to regain some gubernatorial powers. And the Republican leaders of the state legislature are shocked at this effort at a power grab. And I think this is why we Wisconsinites are just so impatient with politicians, that instead of having a consistent point of view, they have a double standard. If it's good for my side, I'll support it. If it's bad for my side, I'll oppose it, even if those two things contradict each other.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kay is with us in Madison. Kay, hello.
Hello, and hello, Mordecai. I used to serve with you on the Poli-Sci Committee years ago.
Oh, my God. Back. Hi, Kay.
I'm back in Madison now after being in New York State and city for several years. I was a campaign aide to a future chief judge of the state of New York, and he taught me to pay attention to the establishment clauses. And the first one in the Constitution is established justice. to my mind, if you don't have equal educations, you're not receiving equal justice. And the Wisconsin's governor's first designated priority in the Wisconsin Constitution is to ensure domestic tranquility. So if you have justice, you have tranquility. So I think it's domestic responsibility and constitutional responsibility to have equality, which means diversity in our universities. And I think the governor is doing his duty constitutionally.
Okay, thanks for the call. Let's go right to that last point. Mordecai Kay thinks ultimately the governor is right, doing his duty, she says, to make this legal challenge to the state legislature.
Well, there's no doubt that based on the specifics of what the lawsuit is, in other words, Kay was talking about the blocking a pay raise for university employees, that one could make an argument that this leads to, let's say, inequitable higher education. Now, it's also possible that the counterargument would be, well, we're affecting all university employees, UW employees, and therefore we're dealing with all of that category of employees fairly. I'm not sure if that's where the lawsuit is going to go. I suspect that it's not going to go that far into the weeds of Kay's argument, but it's going to stop at the issue of the principle of legislative veto being constitutional or not.
Okay, thanks for that call. Mordecai, one other part of the story I want to get into. Governor saying, hey, this should go to the state Supreme Court. It doesn't have to work its way up the usual way through the lower courts and on up the state Supreme Court under new management after our last state Supreme Court election. What do you think of the move to get it straight to the top?
Well, again, it's an issue of where you stand depends on where you sit. In other words, when there was a conservative majority on the state Supreme Court, Republicans were always delighted when the Supreme Court would take original jurisdiction, the way you described it, Rob. In other words, that instead of the Supreme Court being the appellate court, that it would just, bam, take it right away and the case wouldn't have to work its way up the chain of courts. Now there's a Democratic majority, a de facto Democratic majority on the Supreme Court. And so the shoe is on the other foot. And Dems are delighted by this, and Republicans are appalled by it. And it's again, I suppose one could try to strip away the partisanship and say, does the case deserve to be dealt with immediately, this week, this month, as opposed to, let's say, over the course of 6 months or a year or 2 years as it goes from trial level court to the Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court? And I think it just depends on how one judges any specific issue and its urgency in terms of taking it up right away at the Supreme Court.
I want to take our last minute, Mordecai, as I often do when I talk to you, to look back at a past historic example. Tommy Thompson, Republican governor of Wisconsin, long stretch of time with him in the governor's office, Democrats in charge of the legislature. It wasn't all hugs and kisses, but they seem to function in a way that divided government doesn't in Wisconsin now. Am I right? Can we get back there if so?
Well, I know I'm going to sound like an old codger, but I definitely think that when I was in the legislature and there were Republican governors, there were Democratic governors. I was in the legislature from the mid-70s to 1989, and it always struck me as being all of us trying to be reasonable, and compromise was a way to solve problems. And now I think we've gotten to a situation where there's just this lockstep knee jerk. If the Dems are for it, Republicans are against it. If the Republicans are for it, Dems are against it. And nobody's looking at the issues and the merits of the issue, let alone how can we compromise on this? How can each of us get half a loaf? And so I really regret it, because I like your example, Rob. Tommy Thompson believed in compromise, and that's why we remember him so fondly.
Mordecai, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
Anytime. Thanks, Rob.
That's Mordecai Lee, professor emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, former member of the Wisconsin State Legislature. He talked to us about Governor Evers' lawsuit against Republican lawmakers. You can read more about that and follow its progress online at WPR.org. Our state capitol team will be watching that as it progresses, maybe straight to the state Supreme Court. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a new investigation looks into stories behind the statistics when it comes to gun-related deaths, homicides, and suicides here in Wisconsin. The reporter behind that story joins the program, and you can join in as well with your thoughts and your questions for Kate's guest. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8. You can join the conversation right here on the Ideas Network. I don't often write things by hand these days. A to-do list, yeah, maybe a quick note for my wife. The longest bit of writing I do is probably my grocery list. Typing on computer, phone, whatever has taken over a lot of those tasks. But I find when I do write a lot, it seems like my hand gets tired real easy. I don't remember it being that way back in the day. Well, it turns out I'm not alone. The Washington Post reports that this is widespread. A lot of people have exactly that problem. What's going on? A couple things. One, we're using devices more, which can put different stresses on our hands to begin with. Two, this is interesting, writing, it's a fine motor skill. It uses small muscles that aren't getting as much of a workout these days, among other things, because we don't write as much. Good news, there are some stretches that can help. Bad news, even if I do all those stretches, my writing will still be terrible. It always has been. I had to get occupational therapy in elementary school to work on my writing to make it at least good enough for teachers to read. Never pretty, but it worked. My writing now, I can read it, mostly. This is Central Time.